Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, Chapter 5, Texts 23 and 24. Continuing, we're hearing about the process of Archanam. It's a really long purport, so I'm just going to start the reading, like yesterday, from where Mataji left off. This is on page 257 of this book. It says here, Grihastha devotees must adopt the Archana Vidhi, or deity worship, according to the suitable arrangements and directions given by the spiritual master. We heard about that a lot yesterday. Regarding those unable to take to the deity worship in the temple, there is the following statement in the Agni Purana. Any householder devotee circumstantially unable to worship the deity must at least see the deity worship, and in this way he may achieve success also. The special purpose of deity worship is to keep oneself always pure and clean. Grihastha devotees should be actual examples of cleanliness. I guess the brahmacharis are off the hook. That's a joke, anyway. Yeah, in the Bhagavatam, 12th canto, it says the symptom of Kali Yuga is that one of the symptoms of Kali Yuga is that the brahmacharis are always unclean. Their ashrams are kept always unclean. That's why I mentioned that. Anyway, deity worship should be continued along with hearing and chanting. Therefore, every mantra is preceded by the word namaha. In all the mantras, there are specific potencies of which the grihastha devotees must take advantage. There are many mantras preceded by the word namaha. But if one chants the holy name of the Lord, he receives a result of chanting namaha many times. By chanting the holy name of the Lord, one can reach the platform of love of Godhead. One might ask, then, what is the necessity of being initiated? The answer is that even though the chanting of the holy name is sufficient to enable one to progress in spiritual life to the standard of love of Godhead, one is nonetheless susceptible to contamination because of possessing a material body. Consequently, special stress is given to the Archana Vidhi. One should therefore regularly take advantage of both the Bhagavata process and Pancharatriki process. Anyway, so the main point here is that the deity worship is there to keep one with pure habits. Otherwise, for the Bhagavat Marg means simply hearing, chanting, remembering. Then for the Bhagavat Marg, there is no limitations of time and space. It can be done in any sort of condition, clean or unclean. Like sometimes, not sometimes, many times I'll rise and immediately just start chanting. I'll at least clean the face, brush the teeth. And then I immediately start chanting, or we'll just do some achman, little achman, sprinkle on the head and start chanting. Then the devotee said, did you take bath? And then I said, yeah, I took bath. What type of bath? Nam snan, the bathing in the holy names of Krishna. So there are no particular standards of even cleanliness for chanting the holy name and hearing and so on, or purity in general. But with deity worship, there are a lot of standards of purity. And so, in order to keep our habits pure, then the deity worship is prescribed. Then you say, well, what is the value of keeping oneself pure like that? Or in terms of external cleanliness, I'm internally getting clean by chanting the holy name and so on. And the sense of it that I have is that externally, if you don't keep yourself pure, then it increases the mode of ignorance, the influence of the mode of ignorance. And if you're self-realized already, that's not a problem for you because you'll be above the influence of the modes of nature. But if you're not above the modes of nature, then when there's lack of purity, it affects the psychology. And once the mind becomes affected, then it's hard to maintain focus on your spiritual practices of bhakti even. Just like if you keep the room always very dirty, that has a psychological impact. When everything is kept very filthy, when you're not cleaning the body, it has psychological impact and in the form of increasing ignorance. Just like when you see a dirty room and you yourself are dirty also, you just feel like sleeping, like most of the time. For example, there's psychological impact. So then there's value of keeping the externals clean, aside from the internal cleanliness that Archanavidhi helps with. So that's the main point being made in this paragraph. The deity worship is there to keep oneself pure. The other point Prabhupada brings out is that in the deity worship, there's conjugated names of the Lord, such as Vasudevaya or Narayanaya. These are called like conjugated names of the Lord. The names that we chant, Hare Krishna, they're in the vocative. But in the mantras, the names of the Lord, I think they're in a dative case, Chaturhi, which means like when worship is being done, Namaha, it's a different type of case, the name is in. And so even in the deity, Prabhupada is saying that in the deity worship, the chanting of the holy name must continue. And it does continue. In our mantras, we're chanting the holy name constantly. The mantras that you receive from the Guru, the holy name is being chanted constantly, along with the word Namaha, which means to offer oneself in full self-surrender to the deity, like that. Then he points out that even by chanting the holy name of Krishna, it is as if you're chanting Namaha many, many times. So what is the need for even that? And that is also true. That's a true point. But then Prabhupada brings out this point of purity, which is required. So the purport goes on. Deity worship has two divisions, namely pure and mixed with fruit of activities. For one who is steady, deity worship is compulsory. Observing the various types of festivals, such as Janmashtami, Ram Nomi, and Narasimha Chaturdashi, is also included in the process of deity worship. In other words, it is compulsory for householder devotees to observe these festivals. Now let us discuss the offenses in deity worship. These are called as seva aparadhas. It's a long list, so get ready. Buckle up, everyone. A long list here. It takes up 2.5 pages. The following are offenses. A, to enter the temple with shoes or being carried on a palanquin. B, not to observe the prescribed festivals. C, to avoid offering obeisances in front of the deity. D, to offer prayers in an unclean state, not having washed one's hands after eating. That's interesting. E, to offer obeisances with one hand. When I first read Nectar Devotion, this one always stuck out to me. So whenever I would see devotees offering obeisances with one hand, I was like, ooh, they committing offense to the deity. This one, and not to have your feet covered. And I think that's coming up in the list. When to not have your feet covered in front of the deities is also considered an offense. So when I used to always find fault with devotees when I would be sitting there in the back and I would be like, ooh, major offense here, you know, like that. In the beginning of devotional service, you learning so many rules is quite dangerous, actually, because they're usually always meant to be applied to others and never to oneself. Anyway, so the offer obeisances with one hand. F, to circumambulate directly in front of the deity. It's like circumambulate a person in front of the deity is considered an offense to the deity. Because the deity is, everything is meant for the deity's worship and glorification. So if you do so in front of the deity, it's considered an offense. G, to spread one's legs before the deity. I have a story which I shared with some of you before. When I'm a dancer by training. I was a dancer at least. So when I first joined the Krishna Consciousness Movement, I traveled to New Vrindavan with some friends. And they were doing some, how do you say, like letter folding or something like this? Sending out invitations, so they asked us to help. So as a dancer, I sat down. It was just you know, temple room like this, I sat down like in a split. I just did the splits, and I was doing the thing in like a split, you know, the seva. So one devotee was like looking at me like, so he was very gently, he said, you know, you're not supposed to sit with your legs spread like that in front of the deity. This is an offense. H, to sit before the deity while holding one's ankles with one's hands. I, to lie down before the deity. J, to eat before the deity. K, to speak lies before the deity. L, to address someone loudly before the deity. M, to talk nonsense before the deity. N, to cry before the deity. To cry means to cry for material things. Also, for spiritual things you may not also do, but crying because of some material loss or because of lack of material gain. Krishna, just please. I just need to pass this test. That is an offense. Crying before the deity for material things. To argue before the deity. P, to chastise someone before the deity. Q, to show someone favors before the deity. To show someone favor before the deity. I don't know what that one, the purport to that is. Something material, clearly. R, to use harsh words before the deity. S, to wear a woolen blanket before the deity. Like it's wintertime, you come downstairs with your sleeping bag around you or something like that. This is an offense. T, to blaspheme someone before the deity. U, to worship someone else before the deity. V, to use vulgar language before the deity. W, to pass air before the deity. This one really stuck out to me also. I think I've often shared this in class with one sannyasi. I was sitting in the doorway there. He was sitting just in front of us. I'm not going to say who it is. He's a very prominent Maharaj. And myself and Revatsananda Prabhu were sitting in the back. And in the middle of japa period, he just like lifted up and let it rip. It was like extremely heavy. It was like, you know, like ricocheted off the floor and made a very loud sound. And then myself and Revatsananda, we looked at each other, we were like, because of this particular thing. The curtains are closed, so for me it meant in the temple room. That was before the deity. Anyway, we'll see how severe these seva aparajas are. We'll hear it in just a second after we get to these long lists. X, to avoid very opulent worship of the deity, even though one is able to perform it. Y, to eat something not offered to the deity. Z, to avoid offering fresh fruits to the deity according to the season. A, to offer food to the deity which has already been used or from which has first been given to others. In other words, food should not be distributed to anyone else until it has been offered to the deity. B, to sit with one's back toward the deity. C, to offer obeisances to someone else in front of the deity. D, not to chant proper prayers when offering obeisances to the spiritual master. E, to praise oneself before the deity. And F, to blaspheme the demigods and the worship of the deity. These 32 offenses should be avoided. In the Varaha Purana, the following offenses are mentioned. A, to eat in the house of a rich man. Interesting. B, to enter the deity's room in the dark. Now you're supposed to give some illumination. C, to worship the deity without following the regulative principles. D, to enter the temple without vibrating any sound. That's why the bell is there, you know, make some sound. Otherwise, you can knock. Just like the idea, all of these rules are meant to help increase our personalism, by the way. It's just, as we were hearing yesterday, just like you wouldn't fart before someone. You know, it's kind of considered rude. And it's actually impersonal, as if they're not there. You're just like, boom, they're talking to you. I have really funny stories with that. I'm not going to get into that. Similarly, you wouldn't enter someone's house without announcing yourself by knocking or ringing the bell like this. These are the ideas here. E, to collect food that has been seen by a dog. You may be wondering by the preciseness, why a dog instead of not a cat or... Particularly in India, there are stray dogs everywhere, you know, and therefore when you're walking around, you cover the boga. So the idea is that if anyone sees a boga before the Lord has enjoyed it, then through the eyes you are enjoying. So then it's been enjoyed before offering to the deity for his enjoyment and becomes contaminated. Just like you can see, suppose some cake is there. You don't cover it and you walk through the Brahmacharya ashram with it. You go, that looks good. That's, you enjoyed it already. It's contaminated. Or just like when you're cooking for the deities, you're not supposed to taste it before offering to the deities, generally. Generally, you're not supposed to, not, actually never, but anyway, I'm thinking of some cases. So you go, this smells so good. Then it's already been enjoyed. It's contaminated. So in the sense, the idea is like that. Not seen by a dog. That can include a human being also. Did they see it? And in the spirit of enjoyment, it's been contaminated. F, to break silence while offering worship to the deity. G, to go to the toilet during the time of worshiping the deity. H, to offer incense without offering flowers. I, to worship the deity with forbidden flowers. J, to begin worship without having washed one's teeth. K, to begin worship after sex. That's dramatic. L, to touch a lamp, dead body, or a woman during her menstrual period, or to put on red or bluish clothing, unwashed clothing, the clothing of others, or soiled clothing. Okay. Other offenses are to worship the deity after seeing a dead body, to pass air before the deity, so that made it in both lists, to show anger before the deity, and to worship the deity just after returning from a crematorium. After eating, one should not worship the deity until one has digested his food. Otherwise, you'll be burping all that in front of the deity. It's disrespectful. Nor should one touch the deity or engage any deity worship after eating safflower oil or hing. I don't know about safflower oil, but hing, it would smell funny. These are also offenses. In other places, the following offenses are listed. Another one. A, to be against the scriptural injunctions of the Vedic literature or to disrespect within one's heart the Srimad Bhagavatam while externally falsely accepting its principles. That's subtle. B, to introduce differing shastras. C, to chew pan and betel before the deity. D, to keep flowers for worship on the leaf of a castor oil plant. Some of these principles are clearly cultural. Therefore, I'm not relating to all of them. You may not be able to relate. E, to worship the deity in the afternoon. F, to sit on the altar or to sit on the floor to worship the deity without a seat. G, to touch a deity with the left hand while bathing the deity. H, to worship the deity with a stale or used flower. I, to spit while worshiping the deity. J, to advertise one's glory while worshiping the deity. K, to apply tilak to one's forehead in a curved way. That's hilarious. L, to enter the temple without having washed one's feet. M, to offer the deity food cooked by an uninitiated person. And to worship the deity and offer boga to the deity within the vision of an uninitiated person or non-Vaishnava. Oh, to offer worship to the deity without worshiping Vaikuntha deities like Ganesha. P, to worship the deity while perspiring. Q, to refuse flowers offered to the deity. R, to take a vow or oath in the holy name of the Lord. A lot of these don't make sense. Because we would have to be trained up in deity worship. And what is the significance of all these? Some of them are cultural, some of them are psychological, like that. So we would have to be trained up. What is the significance of all these various rules and regulations? So Prabhupada continues here. If one commits any of the above offenses, one must read at least one chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Does that include purports? Or you can recite one chapter of Gita. So for the seva aparadhas are not usually considered very detrimental because they are counteracted simply by recitation of prayers from the Bhagavatam or from the Gita, or simply by chanting the holy name of the Lord, they can be counteracted. So the seva aparadhas are not usually considered very detrimental like the nama aparadhas are. Therefore, we heard in our study of the Madhurya Kandambini with Srila Prabhupada Maharaj, and when he was talking about offenses, Sri Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur specifically pointed out that he was referring to the nama aparadhas and not to the seva aparadhas. He said, because the seva aparadhas are easily counteracted simply by chanting of the holy name or by reciting a chapter of Gita or the Bhagavatam. Of course, if one commits a seva aparadha with that in mind, then it becomes a nama aparadha, the aparadha of committing sin on the strength of the holy name. So Sri Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur specifically points this out. So one need not feel overly burdened by all the rules and regulations. And a lot of this actually pertains to worshiping the deity when you're on the altar and performing actual worship and not just being in the temple room, a lot of the rules. In any case, one need not be excessively concerned as such. Of course, Sri Vishwanath also points out the Madhurya Kandambini, that as one is making advancement in Krishna consciousness, he consciously avoids seva aparadha as well. In other words, it becomes a natural feature of his awareness in Krishna consciousness that it doesn't generally take place. But even if it does take place, then it is easily counteracted simply by chanting a holy name, or as Prabhupada is pointing out here, reading at least one chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada continues, this is confirmed in the Skanda Purana of Antikanda. So I guess you have to look that up. You're looking for the confirmation. Similarly, there is another injunction stating that one who reads the 1,000 names of Vishnu can be released from all offenses. In the same Skanda Purana, Reva Kanda, it is said that one who recites prayers to Tulasi or sows a Tulasi seed is also freed from all offenses. Similarly, one who worships the Shalagram Shila can also be relieved of offenses. In the Brahmanda Purana, it is said that one who worships Lord Vishnu, whose four hands bear a conch shell, disc, lotus, flower, and club, can be relieved from the above offenses. In the Adi Varaha Purana, it is said that a worshiper who has committed offenses may fast for one day at the holy place known as Shokarva and then bathe in the Ganges. In the process of worshiping the deity, it is sometimes enjoined that one worship the deity within the mind. In the Padma Purana Uttarakhanda, it is said, quote, all persons can generally worship within the mind, end quote. The idea here is that one may not have all the necessary paraphernalia because of being destitute, materially destitute, and therefore worship could be performed in the mind for such persons. But it's not like if you have the facility to perform worship, then you perform worship in the mind. That was already mentioned. Prabhupada continues here. This is practically the same sort of purport you were reading in Nectar Devotion. Practically almost the same. The Gautamiya Tantra states, quote, for a sannyasi who has no home, worship of the deity within the mind is recommended, end quote. And the Narada Pancharatra, it is stated by Lord Narayana that worship of the deity within the mind is called Manasapuja. One can become free from the four miseries by this method. Sometimes worship from the mind can be independently executed. According to the instruction of Avirhotra Muni, one of the Navayogindras, as mentioned in Srimad Bhagavatam, one may worship the deity by chanting all of the mantras. Eight kinds of deities are mentioned in the Shastra, and the mental deity is one of them. In this regard, the following description is given in the Brahma Vaivarta Purana. In the city of Pratishtanapura, long ago, There resided a Brahmana who was poverty stricken, but innocent and not dissatisfied. One day he heard a discourse in an assembly of Brahmanas concerning how to worship the deity in the temple. In that meeting, he also heard that the deity may be worshipped within the mind. After this incident, the Brahmana, having bathed in the Godavari River, began mentally worshipping the deity. He would wash the temple within his mind, and then, in his imagination, he would bring water from all the sacred rivers and golden and silver water pots. He collected all kinds of valuable paraphernalia for worship, and he worshipped the deity very gorgeously, beginning from bathing the deity and ending with offering arati. Thus he felt great happiness. After many years had passed in this way, one day within his mind he cooked nice sweet rice and ghee to worship the deity. He placed the sweet rice on a golden dish and offered it to Lord Krishna, but he felt that the sweet rice was very hot, and therefore he touched it with his finger. Now this is all happening in his meditation, right, in his mind. He immediately felt that his finger had been burned by the hot sweet rice, and thus he began to lament. While the Brahmana was in pain, Lord Vishnu and Vaikuntha began smiling, and the goddess of fortune inquired from the Lord why he was smiling. Lord Vishnu then ordered his associates to bring the Brahmana to Vaikuntha. Thus the Brahmana attained the liberation of Samipya, the facility of living near the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That ends the Archanam section of the purport. There's an interesting story in this regard. It's a reason why I keep this picture upstairs in the room. With Narsimha Brahmachari, so when Lord Chaitanya wanted to go from Puri to Vrindavan, at that time, Narsimha Brahmachari was wanting to offer some seva to Lord Chaitanya, but he was some distance away from Lord Chaitanya. So within his mind, he began making a beautiful road, golden road, for Lord Chaitanya from Puri to Vrindavan. And on the road, there were many wonderful flowers and plants and birds and beautiful water and so on. Very nice within his mind. In his meditation, he was not able to go past Kanai Natashala, which is a place in between Puri and Vrindavan. He wasn't able to meditate past that. So he, his meditation wouldn't go past Kanai Natashala. So at that time, he could understand that Lord Chaitanya was not going to successfully go to Vrindavan during that trip. And the reason was, anyway, because Gadara Pandit had been hurt by Lord Chaitanya. Anyway, that's another story. So then he told the devotees that Lord Chaitanya would not go past Kanai Natashala. They're like, how do you know? You're not even, you're sitting here, how can you understand that? He could understand by his meditation, which was being fully offered, accepted by Lord Chaitanya. So Srila Prabhupada writes an interesting purport in this regard. It's in chapter 2 of the Madhyalila, chapter 1 or 2 of the Madhyalila, where he says that one may wonder how it is that he was simply offering seva within the mind. And Prabhupada makes an interesting point. He says that the Lord is bhava grahi janardana, that he accepts the bhava of the offering and not so much the offering itself. Or you can say the offering is a secondary consideration, and the primary consideration is the bhava, the intent or the devotion of the offering. So for the Lord, Prabhupada argues, which is very nice, that he's not interested in anything material. So gross material or subtle material, the Lord is not interested in anything material. So you may offer a gross apple to the Lord, or you may offer a subtle apple to the Lord in your mind. But Krishna is not interested in the gross or subtle apple, because he's not interested in anything material, but rather he's interested in the bhava. And then Prabhupada quotes this verse from Bhagavad Gita, patram pushpam palam toyam yame bhaktya prayachati taraham bhaktya paritam. So the word bhakti is used twice, and the context in which Prabhupada quotes this is refers to bhava clearly. So Krishna eats ashanami prayatatmanaha. He eats prayata atmanaha, that pure offering. So what is that pure offering? That pure offering is the bhava. Krishna really eats the bhava. He's hungry for love, not hungry for gross apples or subtle apples, but he's hungry for love. And it is that bhava that the Lord eats. So he could even literally eat a flower. That is possible for him because it is really the bhava that he's eating through that flower, as we are familiar with the pastime of Vidura's wife offering Krishna 3 banana pills because she was in ecstasy. She was in bhava. As soon as she heard Krishna was coming, she went, had come. She went into ecstasy, and in her ecstasy, she was opening the bananas and throwing out the banana and offering Krishna a banana peel. Three times she did, not one, three times she did. And Krishna accepted the banana pills because he was eating the bhava. So Prabhupada says this, that Krishna's not interested in anything material, gross or subtle. So it is really, as we were hearing yesterday also, it is really, the rules that are followed are simply meant to facilitate a more devotional expression. It's meant to facilitate the mood of devotion towards Krishna. If it becomes all about the rules and less about the devotion, then we are criticized as with the fault of niyamagraha. Niyamagraha means clinging on strongly to regulations without understanding its purpose, essentially. What is the purpose of the rules being applied on a particular stage of devotion? They're meant to help us facilitate ultimately a sweet offering of love towards Krishna, which is what he's eating. So if one loses sight of that purpose and becomes very much interested in the rules and regulations, then they're criticized as having the fault of niyama agraha, clinging too tightly to rules. And that is considered the destroyer of bhakti. It is for this reason that shravanam must accompany all the shravanam kirtana smarana, particularly shravanam I'm pointing out, must accompany all the application of all the other angas, including deity worship, so that you don't lose sight of the objective. That there's an actual objective in our offering of the deity worship and so on. So I was reminded of that particular pastime from Gaur Lila in relationship to this particular point about worshiping the Lord within the mind. Are there any questions? That's deity worship, yeah. Jeremy has a question.
Hare Krishna. I was reminded of a couple things while you were talking. The first was someone once asked Krishna Smarana Prabhu, they said, if it's inconvenient, is it okay to offer food in the mind instead of with the whole elaborate process? And his response was, well, can you eat it in your mind?
No, you offer in the mind, you eat in the mind also.
And I also heard a pastime from Prem Rasa. She said that some early devotees had offered Krishna some burnt sweet rice, and the whole plate of sweet rice just like flew across the temple room. And they asked Prabhupada about this, and he said, of course, you tried to offer the Supreme Lord some like burnt food, he's not going to want to accept it.
For all the empiricists in the room, they're like, come on, it probably just fell off the table.
But my question is about offering obeisances to others when the deities are present, because in practice it seems to be sort of like mixed. Like I see sometimes Rampad Maharaj will come in after Mangal Arati has started and people seem to look awkward, not know what to do. Some people offer obeisances, some don't. What are we supposed to do?
I'm trying to think of a very clever way of saying this without sounding. Anyway, I'll say it like this. The rules, again, are meant to, they have an objective. The objective is ultimately satisfying Krishna. Some say their haritoshanam is the objective of anything in devotion. So that's always the bottom line, what will be pleasing to Krishna. So one who knows that Krishna's devotees are very dear to him and that worship of the devotee is considered superior to worship of Krishna by dint of the reason that they are intensely dear to Krishna. So one may be offering one's respect to such great devotees of the Lord, even in front of the deity, as an expression of pleasing Krishna even, because these persons are very pleasing to you. So one offers, especially in the case of the spiritual master, and the person, Srila Rampara Maharaj, many or most here are his disciples. So that is only very natural, a natural expression of devotion to Krishna, to regard. So when that is in the forefront of the mind, we can hardly say that it's an offense, but rather it is service to Krishna. The sense of the statement, as I was understanding it, is that You know how in the material world we live, we try to be socially viable. And so in that social viable, we start glorifying one another, even in false praise, offering respect to one another, without the pleasure of Krishna in mind, even amongst devotees who are immature. And oh, it's so good to see you, and they're offering obeisance. It's basically a form of sense gratification. So in that sense, it may be because the principle of satisfying Krishna is in the forefront of the mind, then my sense of it is that that's the type of offense that's being talked about, where Krishna is eclipsed from your consideration, and it's all about you and that living entity. It has nothing to really do with Krishna. Then in that sense, it becomes an offense, because Krishna's become eclipsed from your consideration. Like that. That's my sense of it. Like I said, all these rules have very specifics there. Mother Lakshmi Mani might have something in this regard. You might have to turn it on. I don't know if it's on.
And two comments. One in regards to this. One devotee was known by his peers as the ISKCON's Jai Man. And in Vrindavan, he would always glorify Srila Prabhupada a lot when Prabhupada would come. So he would go on, Prabhupada, the savior of the whole universe, Ki Jai, Prabhupada, the most wonderful, fantastic, you know, on and on and on. So Prabhupada came back from his morning walk, and this devotee was doing his thing. And Prabhupada went over to him and said, why don't you do something practical? So what you just said reminded me of that. But the other thing I wanted to share was you had read the idea of not eating in the house of a rich man. And there seemed to be some, well, how does that work? But in Bombay, there were many very senior devotees who were going, well, very senior, they'd been devotees 4 or 5 years. They were going around and collecting Lakshmi in Bombay, and they found themselves being fed in the house of rich people. And they went to Srila Prabhupada, unbeknownst, they didn't know why, but they told Prabhupada that they were feeling very disturbed in mind. They were very agitated, and their minds were agitated. And Prabhupada asked them, are you eating in these houses as you go around? And they said yes. And Srila Prabhupada told them that they should just eat very simply there. That because these people, they think that they can buy anything. They don't really have pure devotion. Even they give some donation, that's nice, but their consciousness is not so good. So then you're eating food cooked in the house of a materialist, and it has an effect on your consciousness.
Even Lord Chaitanya, speaking of the father and uncle of Raghunath Das Goswami, he said, if you eat food cooked by materialists, then your mind will become wicked. And the funny thing about that is that they were actually devoted to Brahminical culture. In fact, there were Vaishnava, prior was the language used. They were almost Vaishnavas, which means like neophyte devotees. And Mahaprabhu, in relation to them, said, if you eat food cooked by a materialist, your mind will become wicked. It's pretty heavy. So, sounds a little harsh, but yeah, that makes sense. Nice. All right. Yeah, another question or comment.
Prabhupada made this comment in the purport that although one can attain the standard of love of Godhead simply by chanting the holy names, we are susceptible to material contamination. Hence, the worship of the deity is recommended. You were also ending your class with this point that if one simply follows the rules and regulations without the stress on Shravanam, then there could be the risk of becoming a Niyam Agrahi. And perhaps that might explain why someone may be worshiping the deity for a long time but not sufficiently getting purified, because the... So my question is this. My understanding is that when there is some actual devotion, then one can harmonize one's external engagements with an internal purpose in mind. And he's not just simply following the rules and regulations. He's actually connecting the external engagement with his internal sense. But lacking genuine devotion, is it possible for a sadhaka to harmonize his external following of rules and regulations with an internal cultivation, or that's just not going to happen for him?
For which person?
A sadhaka who doesn't have, you know, let's say a sadhaka before ruchi doesn't actually have genuine ruchi.
So then if he doesn't have ruchi, then?
Is he just simply reduced to following the rules and regulations?
No, he has to know for what purpose he's doing. Just like in Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's discussion of this Niyamagraha, he says that the nature of the scripture is to give everyone an opportunity to go from the lowest platform to the highest platform of consciousness. And in between the lowest platform and the highest platform, there are many different levels of consciousness. And on each level, there are rules that are meant for persons on that particular level of consciousness. And they follow those rules with the next level in mind as their objective, then those rules help them to elevate. If they become qualified for moving to the next level and they remain attached to the lower level, then that is a fault of niyama agraha, clinging too tightly to rules. If they jump ship too early, this is the other fault of niyama agraha, and try to follow the rules meant for a higher level of consciousness than the level of consciousness that they're on, then they'll also not attain success, they'll fall down. So, Sway Sway Adhikaraya Nishta Saguna Parikirtita, this is the verse that Bhaktivinoda Thakur quotes, that piety means to be fixed according to one's Adhikar. Sway Adhikara Nishta. So, one should be fixed according to one's Adhikar. So, naturally, because especially if you're coming new, we don't know all the levels of consciousness. It is for this reason that able guidance is required to help us ascertain Adhikar. And then one applies according to their Adhikar, the various regulations of the scriptures as described by the spiritual master, with the next stage of evolution in view. So if someone is, you're saying that lacking ruchi, therefore they may lack internal insight, that need not necessarily be a fault in the initial stages. If we're talking about someone before ruchi, that means they're in the initial stages of Krishna consciousness. That is not a fault. Then they have to go on with their hearing and chanting and inquiring from the spiritual master. As they're getting purified, then the types of questions they ask will be transformed progressively. So in the beginning, we're asking the questions, why do good things happen to bad people? Or usually it's said the other way around, but. Or we're asking questions about reincarnation, about consciousness. Many of us are captured by empiricism. So we're asking a lot of questions about atheism, and someone with the atheists are saying seems to make sense, and so on. As you're getting purified by the process of Shravam and Kirtanam, the level of questioning also transforms. Then you start having questions just about the tattva. You know, what is nam tattva? What is bhakti tattva? That needs to be clarified. And that way all doubts are cut to pieces. After one has assimilated that level of Krishna consciousness, then the nature of the inquiry starts to transform. Now you want to hear more about Krishna's qualities, how those qualities relating to his devotees. That becomes very important for you. About his rupa, the nature of his form and the inconceivableness of it. You know, certain less esoteric things about Krishna's rupa, and then more esoteric things about Krishna's rupa, like the color of it, the shape of the limbs and so on. This is mentioned in the four shlokas of the Bhagavatam. Then, as one is more and more purified, then one wants to hear about the leelas of Krishna. And there's where there's an evolution of the investigation into truth. And so sometimes when we hear from advanced devotees without proper guidance, we sometimes want to jump the gun in the evolution of inquiry. For example, you hear a beautiful class about the leelas, and one wants to hear about the leelas, which is not a fault, by the way. It is nice. But you are so unclear about the tattva, then there's a jump in the evolution of inquiry. Krishna says, jama karma chame divyame vam yo veti tattvataha. Those who understand the nature of my jama and karma in tattva. So you have to understand the tattva. That means one would have to have understood particulars about rasa tattva, which is meant for sadhakas. Perfected devotees are relishing rasa. Sadhakas need to hear about the rasa tattva. That allows for insight into the leelas. Many times devotees jump the gun. They feel that no need to understand tattva, I'll just hear the pastimes. Like that, that may not actually be the necessity on a particular level of consciousness that they're at. So therefore, able guidance is always given as a criteria to help us understand the natural evolution of inquiry is the way I'm expressing it now. You know, these are the type of questions that are relevant for you at this particular stage of consciousness from my observation. Like that. And then even when you have those sorts of questions, they can help you to, how you say, get a sense of if that's relevant for you at that present state or not. So what is pariprashna means? Relevant inquiry. Pranipata pariprashna sevya. So relevant inquiry. So then that requires understanding where I'm at in the evolution of Krishna consciousness. And then posing the questions relevant for that stage with the next stage in mind, like this. Yeah, and then Mother Lakshmi has something on this also. Yeah, you
just
can
just quick follow-up. So the essence of what you're saying is that before the onset of Ruchi, and the sadhaka will inquire about the tattvas of devotional service to get a clear understanding of what the different stages of consciousness looks like, and then naturally, as he progresses, he will see a natural progression in his inquiry.
Yes.
Substantially. So then I just have a quick question about, so in terms of deity worship, the tattva underlying deity worship, are we to understand that perhaps at our stage, the deity worship is more like for purification and protection, and then after a certain stage, the deity worship is really much more personal, it's more like Mother Lakshmi was explaining yesterday, there's perhaps a more natural affection towards the deity. So although you're waving the incense, you're waving the chamara, you're offering flowers, you're doing it not so much because that's the ritualistic formula, but rather this is an expression of your affection.
Of course,
for you.
Certainly, that's natural.
I just wanted to say in regards to what your question was at the beginning, that also our relationship, and Prabhupada mentions it in what I read yesterday, that, and you mentioned it also, that guidance is required by the spiritual master, Prabhupada, before he starts that archana section. Where at the very beginning he says, therefore, guidance of the spiritual master is required. And doing our seva, especially deity worship, but doing any seva, with the idea that I'm doing this to please my spiritual master, on the order of my spiritual master, that's also a purifying level of consciousness. Even if I don't think about Krishna, but I think about my spiritual master, that on Prabhupada's order, my spiritual master's order, I'm doing this service. I don't know anything. Just like we have that brahmana who was reading Bhagavad Gita, and he didn't know how to read properly. So he's reading Bhagavad Gita on his guru's order. Every day he was reading Bhagavad Gita. And people were making fun of him because he wasn't reading it properly. But he was entering into the lila of Krishna with Arjuna, and he felt that relationship very intensely, and it changed his heart. But the initial thought was, well, when Lord Chaitanya said, well, why are you reading this if you don't even know how to read? He said, because of my order of my spiritual master. So he said, I should do it every day. So every day I'm doing it because it's on his order. And by following that order to please the spiritual master, then one receives change of heart. Because Krishna says, I'm in the heart. I do the work in the heart. I give you knowledge by which you can come to me.
As it is similar, Gopal Kumar also in the Brihadaratamrita, he also received a mantra from his guru without any explanation of the mantra initially. And so he maintained his chanting of the mantra only because it was given by his guru. So out of regard for his guru, he just maintained the chanting of the mantra, although he did not know of its significance. But there was purification going on by the chanting of his mantra, and that purification is expressed in the Brihadaratamrita as he's going to different realms of being and receiving more and more information from sadhus about the true nature of God and his worship and so on. And because of his chanting of the mantra, he always felt some dissatisfaction with those various planes of explanation. And so that kept him moving along. And that was due to the influence of the mantra, that he was never satisfied in any particular plane until he ultimately reaches Braja, where he finds that his full satisfaction is achieved. So we see simply out of regard for the instruction of the guru, he began chanting. But the purification was evinced as he's traveling through these different planes and receiving, and like I'm using the language I'm using, as an evolution of inquiry. He was asking more and more and more questions. Then later on, in chapter 3 of the second book, he again meets his guru, who then explains to him the meaning of the mantra, and then again disappears. And then again, there's progression, you know, and like this. So it goes on in this way.
Thank you. You're talking about Sve Sve Adhikari Anishta. That means what the words are person, according to the qualification, he's fixed, and yes, that is piety. So let's say if we talk about the higher platform, like Madhavendra Puri, he was talking like Sandhya Vanna Bhadram Astu. I don't want any Sandhya Arati. I don't want this. So doesn't, at that level, doesn't this stage, the lower stage, become more fixed when you go to the next level?
Not necessarily. Also, the question is that Madhavendra Puri, there's this prayer. It's quoted in the Bhagavad Gita, also chapter 2, verse 52 or 53? 52, I think. And Madhavendra Puri is praying that my sandhya 3 times a day, Haribo. My bathing 3 times a day, Haribo. So all the various rules and regulations given in the Vedas, I mean, no fault with you, but Haribo, you know, like this. He just dismisses it. So his question is, when you become more elevated, aren't you necessarily going to be more fixed up on these other things? And the answer is not necessarily. There are 3 types of devotees. I'll explain it in this way. In Baladeva Vibhushan's commentary on Gita, he says that the Gita is speaking about 3 types of devotees. The neophyte is called the Swanishta devotee. Then there are 2 types of pure devotees he mentions. This one type is called the Parinishta devotee, and the other one is called Nirapeksha devotee. So he says that the Parinishta devotee is fixed in pure bhakti, but he wants to set an example for persons who are not so elevated, namely the Swanishta personalities and others. And so he also will externally follow the formulas of Vedic culture for setting an example for those who need to follow such formulas. This is the Yad Yad Acharati Shreshtas verse. The context of that verse is Krishna speaking about Arjuna, even if you are self-realized, 317, Atmarati, even if you are Atmarati. So therefore, the necessity for Dharma is due to a lack of satisfaction. Therefore, some engagement to gain some satisfaction. But from one who is Atmarati, there is no need for Dharma anymore, because the goal of Dharma is already achieved, namely self-realization. One is internally satisfied. He says, even for such Atmarati persons, they also perform Dharma. And then he gives the example of Janak Maharaj, right? One of the Mahajans. They're also performing. Why are they performing Dharma? Because they want Yad Yad Acharati Shreshtas Tatari Votarojana. Because whatever a great man does, common man will follow. And Sayat Pramanam, whatever he does, they will accept as the evidence for what needs to be done for progress. So these are called Parinishta devotees. They are also pure devotees. For them, the regulations are not important. You'll hear other personalities in the scriptures are like Bharat Maharaj, but they even perform various Karmakandhya rites in their kingdom. Why? To set up the example for others, with no faith in it, though, because they have faith in bhakti. So that's one type of pure devotee. There's another type of pure devotee who is called Nirapeksha, and he's just like, Haribo, Sanjavanna, see you later. Bathing 3 times a day, see you later. That will not be necessarily a component of their Krishna consciousness. So the answer is not necessarily. Will that become a component? Not necessarily. Generally, because ours is a preaching movement, we generally try to remain externally fixed up in some sort of proper social conventions. Otherwise, people might get freaked out. You know, there was one reason why Prabhupada wanted devotees to shave their head. You know, you should be clean shaven. He didn't want us looking like hippies, you know, keeping beards and long hair and. But actually, there is no fault. Many sadhus in India, that is natural. There was 2 options. You clean shave, or you just leave it raw, you know, and it gets nappy and you got a huge beard. That was natural. And you just focus on your Krishna consciousness. But ours was a preaching movement. So Prabhupada wanted us to show some sensitivity to certain social conventions for this reason. But it is not incumbent upon such an advanced devotee to do that. It is not necessarily his or her obligation to do so when they're on such exalted states of consciousness. Is there any other one I want to mention? Like this. This is the Nirpeksha platform.
Who is on the Nirpeksha platform? Absolutely means he might have started from Sanishta, then Nishkarma Yoga, and then Parinishta, and then he came to Nirpeksha. He didn't get immediately to the Nirpeksha level, so he must have shaved the hand before. He started his life with shaving his head, and ultimately,
okay,
he, got to the clogs.
Okay.
So he must be fixed in that level then, when he come to the clog level.
Yeah, so of course, so that's the point of the verse, that verse from the Bhagavatam, Sway Sway Adhikariya Nisha. Before coming to one level, yes, he has fixity in the plane before that, until he gains qualification for the plane thereafter. But then, once attaining the plane thereafter, he may let go of some of the rules, or all of them. For the, actually, the evolution as presented by Bhaktivinoda Thakur in his discussion on this verse is that when one is beginninglessly ignorant, so he qualifies for karma yoga. Then by his purification through karma yoga means nishkama karma yoga, he gains qualification for gyan. So when he's qualified for gyan, then he lets go of the varna, some of the varnashram principles and so on. He's just a renunciate. He's focused on gyan. Then when he becomes qualified for bhakti, this is the progression Bhaktivinoda Thakur presents. Then those practices, he also the gyan practices he may let go of, and he just focused simply on shravanam, kirtanam, smaranam. That's how he presents that particular discussion of this verse in the Asya Niyama Agraha. So the idea is that when one is on a higher level, it is not incumbent upon such a Vaishnava for following certain rules on a lower level. He may follow according to his desire. And it's not that he's breaking the scripture because he's following a higher law of the scripture. This is specifically pointed out by Jiva Goswami and Bhakti Sundarbha in regards to a person abandoning Varnashram because of being qualified for Gyan or Bhakti. It is not that he's breaking the scripture, but rather he's following a higher law, if you will, of the scripture. So this is...
level, and he's coming to the low level sometimes. So he must be relishing that low level when sometime he comes to the low level platform to preach other people or...
My understanding, what are you asking, is that if a
suppose
higher
he's
devotee
a very
is
at a high
applying
level.
On a lower level.
Sometime he come to the lower level platform. Okay. So he must be relishing that platform, or he must be just, oh, for that
I can't say what his conscience is. My sense of it is that the necessity of doing so may be out of compassion. But his attraction is not there. His attraction, because of having higher adhikars, attraction is certainly different. But he may apply, and within our preaching movement, we say we will apply for the sake of mercy towards those who are not so qualified like this. Oh, I think Mother Lakshmi Moni wanted this. I don't know. Did you want to say something on this? Yeah.
Whatever works in the situation, if he's preaching, he does what he needs to do to preach. And if he... Lord Chaitanya, even with Ramananda Roy, when he saw people over there watching, he thought, uh-oh, we can't get too intimate here because they're watching and they'll be affected by it. So we, in Prabhupada also, like that. If he was in a public place and he was starting to feel some ecstasy, he would immediately, and he even said, you know, so you saw that, but don't talk about that. That's not my preaching strategy, you know. Then. So he's not, that person is not affected, doesn't even think about it. The fact that we're thinking about it is an indication that we're not there. Because when that person is in that position of so advanced, he's not considering, well, should I or shouldn't I, or I don't like this or I like this. He just does whatever is required by the situation.
Right. Like that. Okay. 2 minutes. Yeah.
2 minutes. Hare Krishna, thank you for
no
class.
Preamble. Just get right to the point.
This is kind of related to Jeremy's point about like when devotees come in, like Raman Pada Maharaj and offering obeisances. I was just browsing through the pastime Ambarish, and one thing I appreciate about that pastime is that when he invited Durvasa, there was kind of a dilemma between two etiquettes when Durvasa Muni came in to take prasadam. You know, Ambarish Maharaj was observing fast, and then Durvasa Muni went to the river.
Okay.
And so time had come for Ambarish to break the fast, but in this proper etiquette that you don't take prasadam before your guest comes back or takes. And Ambarish, he held, you know, the personality, the rasamoni, in higher position than the proper fasting etiquette. So he wasn't gonna break the fast. And but the brahmanas encouraged him to, and then of course the rasamoni got upset. He meditated. So the thing, my question is that there's also seems to be a dilemma in our life is that for Ambarish, the fasting is kind of impersonal, and he held the personal person in higher position. But in regards to our practical experiences, is that sometimes we see, you know, devotees and senior Vaishnavas, there's like debate of, you know, Prabhupada said this, Prabhupada said that, and you can't like follow everything Prabhupada said, and it's almost like a dilemma. Like, I don't want to disrespect, you know, anyone, you know, but I can't follow everything everyone tells me Prabhupada said, and you don't want this because everyone's a person. And how do you go about, you know, respectfully, like, I can't follow everything, I don't even know what Prabhupada said, or, because it seems like there's a dilemma, because everyone's personal, it's not like an impersonal, like, a
Kaddish. Anyway, like, Ambarish Maharaj, first of all, he did break his fast.
No, that's what I'm saying, he did.
He broke it and not broke it. And he came to that conclusion by his own intelligence, the Bhagavatam says. So he asked the Brahmanas, they gave various opinions, and finally he kind of said, I know what to do. He figured it out. So if one is mature, then they know how to harmonize apparently contradicting principles and then act from that platform. And if you can't do that, then you ask someone who can. Like one time, Prabhupada writes a letter to one, Mataji, she was taking care of Tosi. And in this letter, he says that he was giving a few rules about how to take care of Tosi. And then Prabhupada says, and the rest of the stuff is just a matter of common sense. And if you don't have any common sense, then ask someone who does, you know, like kind of a little heavy expression. So in a similar way, if we lack the maturity to harmonize contradictory statements of Prabhupada or other scriptures and so on, and that's affecting our ability to act, then you ask someone who can do that harmonizing work and come to the conclusion what would be the right sort of direction. Like that, simple, no biggie there. All right? All right, thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.